From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell with news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, April 14th, 2021.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by the Maine law firm of Eaton Peabody, serving generations of Maine families and businesses from offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
While adults have been queuing up in the cold, marching through tents, and even driving through to get COVID shots however they can, a national pediatric organization is urging a more cautious approach for when it's time for kids to get theirs.
I know in our hospital settings, the number of children being hospitalized with mental health components has dramatically increased.
At a virtual press conference, Kim Stevens, president of the Association of Child Life Professionals, or ACLP, says the pandemic has created unprecedented stressors for children. And she says while shots are often viewed as a rite of passage, research has shown that a scary experience can lead to a lifelong avoidance of vaccines and clinical care. She says her group had already begun work on the issue before the pandemic hit.
But it's even more important now, knowing what we know about how children are responding and adolescents are responding to the stress.
Dr. Jennifer Jewell with the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital in Portland says there are a number of things parents and practitioners can do to alleviate fear, such as giving a truthful and thorough explanation about the vaccine, allowing a child to pick a fun activity to do before or after the appointment, and using comfort and distraction techniques such as blankets, storytelling, and music. She also says that practitioners need to listen to a child's caregiver on how best to handle each child's fear. COVID-19 vaccine trials are getting underway for juveniles under the age of 12, and health experts estimate that kids could be getting jabs in time for school in the fall. Thomas Delahanty II has died. He served as U.S. Attorney for Maine during the Obama years. In 2015, Delahanty joined drug treatment providers and others to create the Maine Opiate Collaborative. It featured groups focusing on law enforcement, education, and drug treatment.
We cannot be rushed, but we must act with dispatch. As each group finalizes an idea, we want to put it to work.
The collaborative issued a report the next year recommending the expansion of healthcare access, an increase in the number of drug courts, improved treatment services, better prevention programs, and increased prosecution of drug dealers. In addition to his work as a federal prosecutor, Delahanty served as a superior court judge. Governor Mills, in a statement, calls him a champion of justice. Thomas Delahanty II was 75 years old. Well, hospitalizations for COVID-19 in Maine are relatively stable, but emergency departments are seeing a change in the type of patients with the disease. They're younger. People ranging in age from their 20s to their 50s are going to the ER with symptoms that in some cases are severe enough to require a hospital stay. Patty White has more.
At Maine Medical Center in Portland, emergency medicine doctor Nate Mick first noticed a shift in age among COVID-19 patients in the ER a couple weeks ago. Some of these patients in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have mild symptoms, like a cough or sore throat. Others have trouble breathing, so much so that they wind up in the intensive care unit.
That is one of the things that is most striking of about the last couple of weeks. I think anybody that gets COVID severe enough to end up in the hospital, you know, it kind of hits you as a healthcare provider. It definitely hits a little bit closer to home when you start seeing people your own age end up with COVID severe enough to need to be hospitalized.
Mick says these younger patients at Maine Med generally don't have underlying conditions. They're not considered high risk for COVID. So why are they getting sick? Mick says there are several reasons. The virus is evolving. New variants are more contagious and can cause more severe disease. Another reason, he says, is that fewer young people have been vaccinated.
This virus will seek out the leaks in your roof, just like water will. And if you plug one leak by vaccinating the at-risk elderly and the at-risk nursing home patient, the virus will seek out the other hole.
Dr. James Jarvis of Northern Light Health says the uptick in younger patients with COVID-19 is happening across Maine.
Right now, we're seeing an increase in the number of hospitalizations for people who are under the age of 40, and in fact have several 20-year-olds across the state who right now are needing critical care.
In contrast to what Maine Medical Center is seeing, Jarvis says many of the younger patients with severe complications from COVID-19 that he's aware of do have underlying conditions.
Most of them have been, it has been obesity. And so we know that obesity is one of the greater risk factors for severe disease from COVID.
Along with the uptick in younger people seriously ill with COVID-19, there are also more asymptomatic patients, says Faye Collins. She's the director of nursing for Maine Med's emergency department.
The patients that we admit, we test all of them for COVID, whether or not they have any symptoms. We're seeing increases of those tests coming back positive, too, when they're admitted for something totally apart from that.
These increases are coinciding with a rise in case numbers in Maine. The seven-day average for daily cases is 385. That's more than double what it was a month ago. Collins suspects that people are tired of wearing masks and distancing. She says hospital staff are exhausted, too.
They're physically tired. They're morally tired. They're psychologically tired. We really want it to be over. And now that there's light at the end of the tunnel, we don't want people to let down their guard quite yet.
And healthcare providers are imploring people to get the vaccine. They say the fact that fewer older people are requiring hospitalization is evidence of just how effective it is. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
For the past month now, Maine lawmakers have been considering a slate of bills that could sideline Hydro-Québec from an upcoming referendum on Central Maine Power's highly controversial transmission line project. The legislation centers on whether a company wholly owned by the Quebec provincial government should be allowed to spend money to influence Maine voters in a campaign. But the debate is actually bigger than that, and it's drawn the attention of national groups seeking to beat back the tidal wave of corporate election spending that was unleashed by the U.S. Supreme Court's decade-old Citizens United decision. Steve Missler has the story.
When the legislature's Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee held a public hearing last month on bills that would limit foreign influence in Maine ballot campaigns, business and industry groups from around the state lined up to oppose them all. Many of those groups also support the New England Clean Energy Connect, the 145-mile transmission project by CMP that would bring Quebec hydropower into the region through its contract with Massachusetts.
But if that project did not exist, we would still be here today opposing these bills.
Stephen Hudson is a lobbyist for the Industrial Energy Consumer Group, or IECG, a trade association representing Maine's largest energy users. IECG supports the transmission project, but Hudson said barring foreign-owned companies or those with foreign investment from ballot campaigns would potentially sideline its members. That's because Twin Rivers Paper Company is Canadian-owned. Woodland Pulp is owned by a Chinese firm. So is ND Paper. Sappi Paper is owned by a South African firm. Hudson told lawmakers that the foreign influence bills would have the effect of Maine telling those companies, thanks for the local investment.
But we're going to prevent you from protecting your investments when someone seeks to interrupt them through a referendum process.
Gerald Petroselli, an attorney representing the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, says the foreign influence bills might also silence American companies with foreign investors.
What about their rights?
If these arguments sound familiar to arguments made in the landmark Citizens United Supreme Court decision, they should. The ruling scuttled federal limits on campaign spending, allowing corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence elections. Opponents of that decision have unsuccessfully fought to overturn it, but now they're targeting local ordinances and bills in state legislatures that seek to ban election spending by foreign governments and corporations with foreign ownership.
I'm Ron Fine. I'm the legal director at Free Speech for People.
The mission statement on Free Speech for People's tax filings describes it as a group seeking to limit the influence of big money in politics by overturning Citizens United with a constitutional amendment. More recently, Free Speech for People has been supporting local ordinances and state legislation that bar corporations with foreign investors from influencing ballot and candidate campaigns. And that includes the three foreign influence bills in the Maine legislature, which Fine has been lobbying lawmakers to pass, even though his organization has no position in the CMP corridor fight.
Our position is that the decision should be made by the people of Maine, and that the funding for the ballot measure campaign should be predominantly from the people of Maine and not from the foreign-influenced corporations on both sides of the funding the ballot measure campaign right now.
Fine is right that the foreign influence bills could affect not only government-owned Hydro-Québec, but also its corporate opponents in the Corridor campaign. NextEra Energy is an American company, and 2% of its ownership is the Norwegian government's sovereign investment fund. Canadian investment companies hold about a 10% stake in Texas-based Vistra, while Houston-headquartered Calpine's ownership includes the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board. Fine says the foreign ownership of those companies contradicts former Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's Citizens United opinion that said corporations have a right to spend money in elections because, quote, they're associations of citizens. Foreign owners, Fine says, is not the same as American citizens.
And that's not consistent with the notion of democratic self-government when corporate political spending is driven, even in part, by considerations of what would appeal to foreign investors.
A sticking point for Maine lawmakers while evaluating the foreign influence bills is at what percentage of foreign ownership should companies be barred from electioneering. Fine, as well as the group Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, argues the threshold should fall between 1% and 5%. According to a 2019 analysis by the Center for American Progress, a liberal advocacy group and partner for Free Speech for People, those thresholds would include between 74% and 98% of roughly 100 corporations among the S&P 500 stock index. Fine was asked if such a prohibition at the national level would effectively stymie the election spending by corporations unleashed by Citizens United.
This type of legislation would take a large bite out of Citizens United. It would undo a substantial amount of the damage that Citizens United caused.
That might make some Maine lawmakers nervous, but Fine says doing nothing is worse.
Uber, Lyft, and other gig economy companies clinched a major win with the passage of Proposition 22.
Last year, California residents overwhelmingly defeated Proposition 22, a ballot initiative that would have forced ride-sharing companies like Lyft and Uber to treat drivers as employees. Saudi Arabia has invested $3.5 billion in Uber, which helped opponents of Prop 22 outspend supporters by a 12-to-1 margin. That might not have happened had California adopted a foreign influence ordinance like the one the city of Seattle did last year after Amazon, which also has foreign investors, attempted to pack the city council with business-friendly candidates.
We end today's show in Seattle, where a group of progressive city councilors were able to beat back a $1.5 million campaign by Amazon to flip the city council.
Seattle's ordinance is accompanied by another in St. Petersburg, Florida. Several states, including Maine, are considering their own legislation. Fine says some of the legislation is a response to big spending by corporations with foreign investments. But
in cases where it hasn't happened yet in a particular city or state, it's only a matter of time.
Maine lawmakers will soon decide if they want to take that step. If they do, it's likely to be challenged in court. And Fine says his group will join the legal effort to defend it. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Like other industries that rely on the gathering of people, performance venues have struggled over the past year. Last week, venues were promised relief as the federal government announced the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant. The $16 billion program operated by the Small Business Administration is offering grants of up to $10 million. But as Willis Ryder Arnold reports, some venues in Maine aren't seeing much relief.
In a normal season, the Ogunquit Playhouse stage is teeming with bright lights, colorful costumes, and big sounds. And the seats are usually pretty packed as well. The Ogunquit Playhouse is one of Maine's leading performance venues. But executive director Bradford Kenny says during the last year, the theaters lost more than $8 million in ticket sales due to the pandemic.
I think we've been through 16 different budget scenarios. You know, how do you manage and how do you budget for a season when that's how people make a living? You know, we have full-time year-round staff. Union members come to work at the Ogunquit Playhouse, and this is how these folks feed their families and pay their rents and their mortgages.
The Playhouse and other venues worked with Maine's congressional delegation to help craft aspects of the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program. And last Thursday, the federal government announced the grant would be available through an online portal and could be used to cover payroll, rent, utility payments, worker protection expenses, and more. But shortly after the site went live, it crashed and has yet to be reopened. Anita Stewart of Portland Stage says that's left venue operators in limbo, wondering where they stand in a first-come, first-serve scramble.
Everybody I know was sitting at their computer, ready to go, ready to type in all the answers. And the system, after 4 hours, they recognized that it had just crashed. So it was a lot of nail biting, and then it's still on hold, and we'll see what they come up with as a system that will operate.
Stewart says the grant program provides venues with the hope to continue on. Portland Stage is currently working to produce a show for a limited audience that complies with COVID-19 restrictions. She says it's important to remain connected to the audience.
It's a way of staying in touch and staying involved with the community. I'm not making money doing it. I'm trying not to lose my shirt doing it, but it seems important to be here and be a part of the community.
Representatives with the Small Business Administration, which oversees the grant, declined an interview, but said in an email that the portal was shuttered after numerous technical issues were identified that hindered the process of applications. The statement said, quote, "We understand the need to get relief quickly to this hard-hit industry." Bradford Kenny of the Algonquin Playhouse says ensuring that performance venues receive support isn't just a question of survival for the arts.
It's really how you're going to strengthen your main streets. Theaters I'm talking about even there are these, you know, long-term institutions that we call historic, and certainly not only in their buildings but in their cultural impact. And they've been feeding and, you know, upholding a lot of these small towns in Maine for a long time.
Venue operators are still able to register for the portal, and the SBA says it will let participants know when the grant process reopens. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow morning on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock for a discussion on tax and personal finance. I'm Jennifer Mitchell.